midst of antagonism, part 4, the Whispering Campaign. I was authorized to go among the Cheyennes, Arapahoes, Kiowas, Apaches, and Comanches within the limits of this department to make a display of force to them, to notify them that if they wished for war, they could have it, and to explain to them fully that hereafter they must keep off the routes of travel, railroads, and other roads, and that all depredations and molestations of travelers must cease forthwith. I was also empowered to arrest any offenders of the tribes above named who should be designated by their agents as being guilty of offenses against the laws, and to explain to the Indians and impress upon their minds the fact that all threatening of our military posts by them, verbally or by messengers or otherwise, must cease at once, or war would ensue. Major General Winfield Scott Hancock. In March 1867, Major Douglas's report on the Indian councils held at Fort Dodge was sent to the Department of Missouri. The report revealed Satanta's threat to attack the post in spring. In response, crucial orders were issued to gather intelligence information on the intent of the southern tribes and employ additional guides and interpreters. The scouts, playing a pivotal role in this operation, were instructed to closely monitor the movements of women and children in the Indian camps, as any relocation could potentially indicate an attack on the military posts or settlements in western Kansas. They were also tasked with verifying the continued supply of guns and ammunition to the Indians and identifying any Sioux Indians among the southern tribes. Their vigilance and dedication were critical to the success of this mission. If Satanta's foretelling were to come true, a council with the Sioux would precede a general assault by the northern and southern plains tribes. The potential for violence was high, leading to the decision to hold wagon trains wishing to move westward at Fort Larned until a party of at least 20 wagons could be formed. Each wagon train was required to elect a captain, and every adult male was mandated to possess a suitable firearm for defense against the Indians. The seriousness of the situation was underscored by the fact that if an attack were to occur, the captain would be responsible for organizing the defense of the train. Troop detachments were dispatched in relays with each group of wagons until the next post along the commercial routes was reached. The old guard was replaced with a newly assigned detachment that would accompany the wagon train to the next post, ensuring a continuous state of preparedness. Wild West Podcast proudly presents In the Midst of Antagonism, Part 4, The Whispering Campaign. Soon after receiving Major Douglas's report, the Department of Defense reviewed the charges and explanations from the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Department of Missouri. The government's offer for peace was unsuitable to the Plains tribes, and it did not pledge that they could retain the vital grazing grounds used by the buffalo herds during their annual migration through western Kansas. This loss would profoundly affect their way of life. By late March, the prairies were gradually turning green in response to the added warmth of early spring, and the time had come for Satanta's long-awaited struggle for the plains, a moment fraught with tension and uncertainty. In March of 1867, Major General Winfield Scott Hancock received the following authorization from Lieutenant General William T. Sherman. I authorize you to organize out of your present command a sufficient force to go among the Cheyenne, Arapaho, or Kiowas, or similar bands of Indians, and notify them that if they want war, they can have it now. But if they decline the offer, then impress on them that they must stop their insolence and threats. Under Sherman's directives, General Hancock embarked on the monumental task of organizing the expedition to the central Great Plains. To quell the Indians' uneasiness, he mustered an imposing force of 1,400 soldiers at Fort Leavenworth for a springtime show of force. Hancock was convinced that a robust demonstration would awe the Indians into passivity and compliance. General Hancock, driven by his political ambitions, set off from Fort Leavenworth in late March 1867, fully equipped to confront the Cheyenne in western Kansas. Accompanied by 7 infantry companies, 8 cavalry, and an artillery battery, he also brought the press to publicize his efforts. However, his lack of knowledge and curiosity about the culture of the people he sought was glaring. He was not interested in understanding them, but in fighting them. His words, "I think it would be to our advantage to have these Indians refuse the demands I intend to make. A war with the Cheyennes would answer our purpose," reflects his misguided approach. The primary task of the expedition had been outlined in the general field orders issued to the general explaining his assignment on the plains. It is uncertain whether war will result from the expedition. It will depend upon the temper and behavior of the Indians with whom we may come in contact. We prepare for battle and will make it if proper occasion presents. We shall have war if the Indians are not well disposed towards us. If they are for peace, and no sufficient ground is offered for chastisement, we are restricted from punishing them for past grievances recorded against them. These matters have been left to the Indian Department for adjustment. No rudeness will be tolerated from any bands of Indians we may encounter. We wish to show them that the government is ready and able to punish them if they are hostile, although it may not be disposed to invite war. Before the mobilization from Fort Riley started, Agent Wynkoop was advised to gather the primary chiefs of the Plains tribes at Fort Larned for counsel with General Hancock. With a hopeful heart, Wynkoop anticipated a peaceful resolution when, in March 1867, Major General Winfield Scott Hancock informed him that he intended to conduct a military expedition along the Arkansas River. Hancock pledged that he was not aspiring to wage war, and that he would collaborate with Indian agents. However, Hancock's course could not have been better calculated to commence hostilities. His 1,400 troopers marched from Fort Riley to Fort Larned, while Wynkoop summoned Cheyenne leaders to talk with Hancock. Edward Wanshear Wynkoop, a man of humble beginnings, was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, on June 19, 1836. He grew up in the state's coal regions, which shaped his character and values, and later moved to Lecompton, Kansas Territory, to work in the United States Land Office. In 1858, at 22, he arrived in Denver City and became a prominent figure, serving as Denver's first sheriff. During the Civil War, Wynkoop joined the Colorado Volunteers and played a crucial and commendable role in the Union victory at the Battle of Glorieta Pass in New Mexico, where his strategic decisions and leadership skills were instrumental in securing the Union's success. In the spring of 1864, Major Wynkoop and Captain Sewell were assigned to Fort Lyon, Colorado. A significant event known as the Sand Creek Massacre occurred during their time there, leading to ongoing disagreements throughout the state. The Cheyenne Indians were causing disorder in southeastern Colorado, and Fort Lyon was tasked with stopping their attacks. Scouting parties from various garrisons, including Fort Lyon, had been harassing the Indians. However, peace negotiations seemed possible when a Cheyenne warrior named One Eye approached the fort as a messenger. Despite the danger, Major Wynkoop decided not to harm One Eye and conversed with him. The Cheyennes agreed to surrender as prisoners of war and camp at Sand Creek, with Chiefs Black Kettle and White Antelope acting as hostages. Additionally, the Cheyennes handed over 4 white captives. Major Wynkoop, along with his hostages and other chiefs, traveled to Denver to seek assistance from the governor in negotiating a peace treaty with the Cheyenne. However, their efforts were unsuccessful, and Wynkoop returned to Fort Lyon. In the meantime, a regiment called the 3rd Colorado Volunteers was formed to protect settlers from Cheyenne attacks. Colonel Shivington was put in charge and led the regiment southward to attack the Cheyenne camp at Sand Creek. Major Anthony, who replaced Wynkoop at Fort Lyon, promised to protect the Cheyenne, but was overruled by Shivington. Captain Sewell, however, refused to participate in the massacre, even when threatened with arrest by Shivington. The 3rd Regiment successfully carried out the brutal attack, resulting in the deaths of defenseless men, women, and children. Major Wynkoop was outraged by the massacre and demanded punishment for Shivington and his command. However, hidden forces within the military sought to punish Wynkoop for leaving his post, despite the necessity of his actions. An investigation exonerated Wynkoop and praised his leadership, ultimately appointing him chief of cavalry for the Upper Arkansas District. Shivington and some officers narrowly avoided imprisonment, but faced criticism from the War Department. However, his protests against the Sand Creek Massacre caused him to lose public support. Disillusioned with the situation in Colorado, he resigned from the Army in 1866 and traveled to Washington, D.C. to meet with President Andrew Johnson. Wynkoop hoped to be appointed as an agent for the Cheyenne and Arapaho Indian tribes, but Johnson initially wanted him to remain in military service. Eventually, the president agreed to appoint Wynkoop to the position he desired. Subsequently, Wynkoop was sent to Fort Larned, Kansas, to begin his new duties. Along the way to Fort Larned, Hancock mustered the services of the 7th Cavalry Regiment at Fort Riley and welcomed Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer, who commanded the regiment. Custer's assignment was to lead the cavalry strike force to pursue and eradicate the Indians if necessary. In addition to Custer's troops, he oversaw 1 detachment of white scouts and another of 15 Delaware Indians under Fall Leaf. James B. Wild Bill Hickok, Jack Harvey, and Tom Atkins were 3 of the more noted white scouts, along with Edmund Guerrier, a French Indian guide and interpreter. In addition to the field grade officers of Hancock's command and the group of Plains chieftains, a curious group of newspaper correspondents and area notables, such as David Butterfield of the Butterfield Stage Company, gathered to witness the proceedings. On April 9th, Hancock's column reached the site of Fort Larned, camped along the banks of the Pawnee 1 mile east of the fort. Their march had been long and tiring, but it had brought them deep into the Plains Indians' country and to the point where Hancock and his subordinates believed they were to meet the chiefs of the Southern Plains. During the evening, a severe storm with heavy winds hit the command near Fort Larned, lasting until 10 p.m. Luckily, no men were lost as they were in camp, which would almost indeed have been the case had the column been on the march on the open prairies. For at times, the snow was so blinding that it was tough to move from one point to another in camp. The animals were saved by doubling their corn ration. The snow accumulation measured 8 inches. Due to the storm, the planned April 10th council meeting with Cheyenne was postponed. On the 11th, Colonel Wynkoop informed Hancock that the Cheyennes and Sioux wanted to hunt buffalo and would not make the April 11th council at Fort Larned. Although Hancock thought the circumstance suspicious and not sufficiently significant to warrant the Indian keeping their engagement with him, he decided to wait another day before marching toward the Indian camp. It wasn't until late on the evening of April 12th that a small entourage of Indians appeared, riding in from the west along the Pawnee Fork. When they reached the expedition encampment, General Hancock prepared a Sibley tent and issued the necessary rations. They were the 3 chiefs of the Dog Soldier Cheyenne: Tall Bull, Bull Bear, White Horse, White Hair of the Omahisho Band, and Lean Face from one of the smaller southern bands. They were accompanied by 10 to 12 warriors, whom Hancock described as men of less importance. General Hancock was openly critical of the tribes when he found that some of their chiefs were missing when the initial council was convened. The general considered their absence evidence of willful arrogance rather than the result of tardy notification. The council took place around a fire built outside the commander's tent. During the council, Hancock discussed issues with the Native American chiefs. He mentions a boy and a girl who have been found, captives of the Cheyenne tribe, and are to be returned to their families. Hancock demanded the chiefs to return any other captives and warned of consequences if they did not. He tells the chiefs that he has brought soldiers, prepared for war, and reminds the chiefs that they cannot win in a conflict with the U.S. Hancock also mentions the importance of upholding treaties and allowing safe passage for white people on roads and railways. He advises the chiefs to appoint a great chief to be held responsible for the actions of their tribe. Hancock promises to protect good Indians and punish bad ones. He concludes by stating he will put his words in writing and distribute them to military posts. The chiefs must decide between war and peace. Hancock concluded the April 12th meeting by revealing he wanted to meet with the other chiefs. Still, they begged Hancock to keep the soldiers away from their village, as their people were fearful of an attack like the one Shivington had committed at Sand Creek in November of 1864. Hancock ignored their concerns and proceeded west the next day to the village of 300 lodges. Major General Hancock understood that the Indians planned to remain in their village and that the council would be held the following day. As the army drew nearer the village on April 14th, the sight of a massive formation of troops so near their village aroused memories of the Sand Creek Massacre. A group of Cheyenne warriors rode out to meet them, reflecting their display of military strength. Colonel Ned Wynkoop, the Cheyenne and Arapaho agent at Fort Larned, rode out between the lines to ask the warriors to stay calm and put. The warriors agreed. The army marched within 1 mile of the village. Captain Albert Barnett of the 7th Cavalry later wrote of the camp, "I was astonished at its magnitude and magnificence." On April 15, 1867, a personal examination of an abandoned Indian village revealed an old Sioux who was sick and a young girl believed to be partly white who had been mistreated by the Indians before they deserted their camp. The girl, around 8 years old, is being taken care of while efforts are made to identify her. Many lodges were found cut, suggesting a hasty retreat. Major Wynkoop worked diligently to provide complete reports of the events unfolding on the frontier. Overall, the situation was tense, and action was being taken to address the escalating events in the area. The camp showed signs of hostility, and the presence of several prominent Indian chiefs suggested possible aggression. General Custer was instructed to search for the girl named Cut Nose, who was reportedly held captive by Cheyenne chief. The plan was to move troops to Fort Dodge and possibly to Colorado and New Mexico, depending on the situation with the Indians. The escape incensed Hancock. He ordered Custer to pursue the fleeing Indians. On April 15th at 5 o'clock, Custer embarked on his relentless pursuit of the Indians, leading four squadrons of the 7th U.S. Cavalry. Custer discovered their trail a short distance from the abandoned village and swiftly followed it toward Walnut Creek. As he approached, he found an abandoned campsite, a clear sign of the Indians' hasty flight. The evidence was compelling, with their burning fires still smoldering. Further exploration led them to ponies, loaded and packed, tied to trees. The Indians had been too hard-pressed to carry them off, a testament to Custer's relentless pursuit. The four cavalry squadrons followed them closely, their trail crossing Walnut Creek and leading along its left bank toward its bedwaters. He found that he was gaining upon them rapidly, and learned from his Delaware scouts that they had seen small parties of Sioux or Cheyenne, evidently the rear guard, before him. Even though he had difficulty crossing Walnut Creek, he was confident he would overtake the Indians. At this point in the pursuit, Custer left his wagons containing forage and ammunition to follow. He ordered one cavalry squadron to guard the wagons and ammunition, and pushed on with his remaining force, hoping to overtake them before nightfall. As the pursuit intensified, the Indians, feeling the heat, broke into numerous small bands and scattered in different directions. Throughout the afternoon, Custer and his scouts realized they had lost the trail, a surprising turn of events. Being new to the Indian tactics, Custer failed to recognize a familiar Indian tactic. Fearing for their families and managing weak and overburdened ponies, the Indians realized the danger of trying to outpace the cavalry. Therefore, they evaded the pursuit by scattering into smaller groups, catching Custer off guard. Seeing the division of trails, Custer had the cavalry follow the main trail, which led in the general direction of Walnut Creek. The pursuit of the Indians on the main route continued until about 5 p.m., when the track became so small that it was narrowly observable. Having marched over 35 miles continuously, except while watering, the troops halted and encamped at the headwaters of Walnut Creek. The cavalry camped and cared for their horses. At 4 a.m. on the morning of the 16th, they again marched in pursuit of the main trail. It was a miserable day with cold, sleet, and rain. Each mile traveled eastward must have been a painful reminder to Custer of the fruitless westward miles he had been duped into covering while following false trails. Custer moved his troops through the valley of a small stream in the direction of smoke seen by his Delaware scouts the previous evening. Traveling in that direction, they hoped to find the Indians encamped or strike their trail. However, they were disappointed after marching 13 miles without discovering any signs of the Indians. Undeterred by the setback, General Custer pressed on, his resolve unshaken. Despite the inaccurate information about the country and his distance from Smoky Hill, Custer retraced his steps to Walnut Creek, a testament to his resilience. He rested his animals and pushed on to Smoky Hill, where he believed the Indians had gone, hoping to intercept them before they crossed that stream. This display of unwavering determination in adversity is a hallmark of Custer's character. Unfortunately, Custer's information concerning the country where he was operating and his distance from Smoky Hill was inaccurate. As it was, his guides whom he relied on deceived him, causing him to order a retrograde march 9 miles off the trail to acquire water. While his troops rested and cared for their horses, Custer took his dogs out on the plains for a buffalo hunt. During his hunt, he accidentally shot his horse and stranded himself on the prairie. Fortunately, a patrol from his unit found him and returned the embarrassed colonel to his command. Custer writes about his lone venture in hunting buffalo in his book, My Life on the Plains. Determined to end the chase and bring down my game, I again placed the muzzle of the revolver close to the body of the buffalo, when, as if divining my intention and feeling his inability to escape by flight, he suddenly determined to fight and at once wheeled, as only a buffalo can, to gore my horse. So sudden was this movement, and so sudden was the corresponding veering of my horse to avoid the attack and retain my control over him, I hastily brought up my pistol hand to the assistance of the other. Unfortunately, as I did so, my finger, in the excitement of the occasion, pressed the trigger, discharged the pistol, and sent the fatal ball into the very brain of the noble animal I rode. I found myself whirling through the air, over and beyond my horse's head. In a moment, the danger I had unluckily brought myself stood out in bold relief before me. Here I was, alone in the heart of Indian country, with warlike Indians known to be in the vicinity. I was not familiar with the country. I was at a loss to know how far I had traveled, or in what direction from the column. In the excitement of the chase, I had lost all reckoning. Indians were liable to pounce upon me at any moment. My command would not tote my absence probably for hours. Two of my dogs overtook me, and with mute glances, first at the dead steed, then at me, seemed to inquire the cause of this strange condition of affairs. Their instinct appeared to tell them that they were in misfortune. After wandering about 3 or 4 miles, Custer saw a column of dust that he knew had to be one of three causes: white men, Indian, or buffaloes. Fortunately for him, Custer had stumbled on his cavalry on this occasion. Custer's delay at Walnut Creek lasted until 7 p.m., when he marched toward Smoky Hill, striking that stream 13 miles west of Downer's Station. The scouts believed the Indians had gone north toward the Smoky Hill River. This delay cost him many hours of valuable time. Afterward, Custer ascertained that if he had kept directly on the same course, he would have reached Smoky Hill River about 15 miles from where he had turned back. This continued course, which he was initially following, could have significantly prevented the destruction and killing at Lookout Station. Custer arrived at Downer Station on April 17th and discovered that Sioux and Cheyenne Indians had been crossing the Smoky Hill, attacking and looting stations along the way, causing alarm and disrupted stage travel in the area. An officer who had just left Lookout Station, traveling over the overland route, had arrived that evening. The officer reported that he had learned from frightened station employees about the extent of the Indian outbreak, with stage stations being attacked and burned along the route. Stage stations were found abandoned, with occupants gathering for defense against the Indians. The officer encountered the aftermath of the Indian outbreak at Lookout Station, where the bodies of three station keepers were found mangled and burned. The Indians had tortured them before killing them, scalping and disfiguring them. The tribe responsible could not be definitively identified, though some scouts recognized Sioux and Cheyenne. The officer continued his journey, seeing more burned stations and evidence of the recent violence committed by the Indians. The situation was dire, with the frontier people facing a dangerous and brutal conflict with the Native American tribes. Custer sent a dispatch to Hancock warning of Indian engagements in the area, and that the escaping band of Indians he was pursuing was responsible for the carnage. On April 18th, Custer left Downer Station for Lookout Station to investigate the attacks. Heading east, Custer at Stormy Hollow Station received significant intelligence that indicated a large body of Indians had crossed over the trail and moved north on April 15th. Custer realized that his estimate of the situation in the April 17th dispatch to Hancock needed to be corrected. He had previously believed that the Indians crossed over the stage road beginning on April 16th. For the Pawnee Fork Indians to have made a 50-mile movement over 2 nights in 1 day was a very plausible trek for Plains Indians. However, new information revealed that they had crossed the road on April 15th, 12 hours earlier. That would have meant covering 50 miles in less than 24 hours. This seemed much less likely to Custer, considering the Indians traveled with hundreds of women and children on weak, overburdened ponies. Custer then continued towards Fort Hays, where he received reports of hundreds of armed Indians passing by Stony Hollow Station, displaying hostile intentions. Some claimed to be friendly, with papers from Fort Laramie officers, but were likely Sioux and Cheyenne who had abandoned their villages. Custer also heard of other Indian parties headed north and saw their trails, but decided not to pursue them due to limited supplies. The situation was tense, with multiple Indian groups causing havoc in the region, leaving a trail of destruction in their wake. Custer believed that the Indians had moved towards the North Platte, so he replenished his supplies at Hays and then surprised them at Solomon Fork. However, he found no forage for his expedition when he reached Fort Hays. The lack of supplies for his horses prevented him from continuing the pursuit. Despite marching quickly from Pawnee Fork, covering 154 miles in 4 days, Custer was forced to abandon his mission due to the need for more supplies. He had hoped to intercept the Indians at the Solomon Fork or Beaver Creek, but the delay at Hays made it impossible. To continue his pursuit, Custer had to bring forage from Fort Harker, which was frustrating for him as he believed that he could have overtaken the Indians within the next 2 days if he had executed his planned movement from Hays. When forage was secured, Hancock ordered Custer to resume operations, allowing him to pursue Indians by following their trails. Additionally, Hancock tasked Custer with protecting the mail route and taking charge of the Smoky Hill Line. In the meantime, Hancock waited with the infantry, artillery, and cavalry for news from Custer at Pawnee Fork, near the Indian village. He had guarded the village and decided to burn it as punishment for Indian treachery, pending confirmation of outrages on Smoky Hill. Upon Custer's first report of Indian depredations at Lookout Station, Hancock ordered the destruction and removal of the villages on April 19th. Some lodges were taken to Fort Dodge, while some valuable items were destroyed. Hancock decided to burn the village and destroy the items left behind by the Indians, including robes, camp kettles, and axes. Hancock warned various military posts to take precautions and guard against potential trouble with the Cheyenne and Sioux. Major General Hancock, under Special Field Order No. 13, ordered a Cheyenne village burned to the ground. Special Field Order No. 13 states the following. As a punishment for the bad faith practiced by the Cheyenne and Sioux who occupied the Indian village at this place, and as a chastisement for murders and depredations committed since the arrival of the command at this point by the people of those tribes, the village recently occupied by them, which is now in our hands, will be destroyed. Captain G.W. Bradley, AQM, the expedition's chief quartermaster, will preserve and treat all property within the village, such as tools, camp equipment, etc., as captured property. Brevet Major General J.W. Davidson, Major 2nd U.S. Cavalry, Acting Inspector General of this department, will take an accurate inventory of all species of property in the village before its destruction. Brevet Major General A.J. Smith, Colonel 7th U.S. Cavalry, Commanding District of Upper Arkansas, is charged with executing this order. By command of Major General Hancock, signed W.G. Mitchell, Captain, AAA General. Colonel Ned Wynkoop was not pleased with Hancock's order to burn the Indian village, so he took it upon himself to write an unsettling letter to the Commissioner of Indian Affairs in Washington, D.C. In the correspondence, Wynkoop remarks how he accompanied General Hancock on an expedition to hold a convivial council with tribal leaders. The report exploits how the excursion ended disastrously when the Indian villagers fled upon Hancock's arrival. Wynkoop describes how two women in the camp were left behind as the men deserted the village, leaving their belongings and the village deserted. He summarizes the correspondence by expressing how General Hancock sent General Custer to pursue the fleeing Indians. At the same time, he wrote his statement expressing his concerns that destroying the village would only escalate tensions. "I fear that this incident could lead to a general war, which would endanger many unprotected whites in the area. I will provide a full report as soon as possible." In a follow-up letter from Colonel Wynkoop to Honorable N.G. Taylor, dated April 18, 1867, it was mentioned that a courier had arrived in his camp from General Custer, who was pursuing the Sioux and Cheyenne. The Cheyennes had gone toward the Arkansas River, while the Sioux continued northward. Custer had reported that the Sioux had destroyed a mail station and killed three men. Colonel Wynkoop appealed to preserve the Cheyenne village, as there was no evidence of their involvement in the hostilities. In the letter to N.G. Taylor, Wynkoop states the following. "There is no evidence in General Custer's report of the pursuit of the Sioux and Cheyenne from the village on the Pawnee Fork that would go to prove that they had separated or that the Cheyenne were not implicated in the killing and burning of the three men at Lookout Station on the 15th of April and burning of the station." Don't miss the chance to delve deeper into the history of the Western Cattle Trail, a significant part of our Western heritage. Sign up for a free Western Cattle Trail newsletter for a limited time. The newsletter will include featured articles by noted Western authors on historical accounts of the cattle drives of the 1880s. Additionally, Those who receive the free newsletter will get exclusive updates on upcoming conferences, minutes from the WCTA meetings, legislative updates on trail activities, and announcement of historical events along the trail. So sign up today for a free, limited-time WCTA newsletter and embark on a journey through the rich history of the Western Trail. To register for your free WCTA newsletter, go to westerncattletrailassociation.com and select the newsletter sign-up link. That's it for now. Remember to check out our Wild West Podcast shows on iTunes or wildwestpodcast.buzzsprout.com. You can also catch us on Facebook at facebook.com/wildwestpodcast or on our YouTube channel at Wild West Podcast, Mike King, YouTube. So make sure you subscribe to our shows listed at the end of the description text of this podcast to receive notifications on all new episodes. Thanks for listening to our podcast. Make sure you check out the Western Cattle Trail Association website at westerncattletrailassociation.com. If you have any comments or want to add to our series, please write us at wildwestpodcast@gmail.com. We value your input and will share your thoughts as they apply to future episodes. Join us next time as we travel back in time to Dodge City during its cattle drive heydays and follow Andy Adams as he takes us through the streets of a wild and woolly cowtown.